Chapter 50. The de Havilland Otter touched down harshly on the flat ice runway, then taxied to a small block building with Tuktoyaktuk painted in faded lettering on it. As the plane's twin propellers ground to a halt, an airport worker in a thick orange jumpsuit jogged up and opened the side door, letting a blast of frigid air into the interior. Pitt waited at the back of the plane as the other passengers, mostly oil company employees, donned heavy jackets before exiting down the stairs. Eventually making his way off the plane, he was welcomed by a numbing gust that knocked the temperature several degrees below zero on the wind chill factor. Hustling toward the small terminal, he was nearly sideswiped by a rusty pickup truck that had crossed the runway and rattled to a stop in front of the door. A squat man hopped out, covered from head to foot in multiple layers of cold weather gear. The bulky clothing gave him the effect of a giant walking pincushion. "Would that be King Tut's mummy, or my director of underwater technology buried under there?" Pitt asked as the man blocked his path. The man yanked a scarf away from his jaw, revealing the staunch face of Al Giordino. "It is I, your tropics-loving director of technology," he replied. "Hop into my heated chariot before we both turn into popsicles." Pitt grabbed his luggage off a cart headed toward the terminal and threw it into the open truck bed. Inside the terminal, a plain-looking woman with short hair stood by the window staring out at the two men. As they climbed into the truck, she walked to a payphone in the terminal and promptly made a collect call to Vancouver. Giordino shoved the truck into gear, then held his gloved hands in front of the heater vent as he stepped on the gas. "The ship's crew took a vote," he said. "You owe us a cold-weather pay bonus plus a week's vacation in Bora Bora at the end of this job." "I don't understand," Pitt smiled. "The long summer days in the Arctic are renowned for their balmy weather." "It ain't summer yet. The high was 12 degrees yesterday, and there's another cold front moving our way. Which reminds me, did Rudy escape our winter wonderland successfully?" "Yes. We missed each other in transit, but he phoned to tell me he was warmly ensconced back at NUMA headquarters." "He's probably sipping Mai Tais along the banks of the Potomac this very moment just to spite me." The airfield was adjacent to the small town, and Giordino had only a few blocks to drive until reaching the waterfront docks. Located on the Bering coast of the Northwest Territories, Tuktoyaktuk was a tiny Inuvialuit settlement that had grown into a small hub for regional oil and gas exploration. The turquoise hull of the Narwhal came into view, and Giordino drove slightly past the vessel, parking the truck next to a building marked Harbor Master's Office. He returned the keys to the borrowed truck inside, then helped Pitt with his bags. Captain Stenzeth and Jack Dahlgren were quick to greet Pitt as he boarded the NUMA ship. "Did Lauren finally take a rolling pin to your noggin?" Dahlgren asked, spotting the bandage on Pitt's head. "Not yet. Just a result of some poor driving on my part," he answered, brushing aside the concern. The men sat down in a small lounge near the galley as cups of hot coffee were distributed to all. Dahlgren proceeded to brief Pitt on the abbreviated discovery of the thermal vent, while Stenzeth discussed the rescue of the Canadian Ice Lab survivors. "What's the local speculation on who could have been responsible?" Pitt asked. "Since the survivors' description perfectly matches that of our frigate, the Ford, everyone thinks it was the Navy. We've been told, of course, that she was 300 miles away at the time," Giordino said. "What no one seems to consider is that there are very few active icebreakers up here," Stenzeth said. "Unless it was a rogue freighter risking its own skin or foolishly off course, the potential culprits are relatively small in number. The only known American icebreaker in these waters is the Polar Dawn," Giordino said. "Make that a Canadian icebreaker now," Dahlgren said, shaking his head. "She doesn't match the description anyway," Stenzeth said, "which leaves a handful of Canadian military vessels, the Athabasca escort ships, or a foreign icebreaker, possibly Danish or even Russian. Do you think it was a Canadian warship that struck the camp by accident, and they're trying to cover it up?" Pitt asked. "One of the scientists, Bew was his name, swears he saw an American flag, in addition to the hull number that matches the Ford," Dahlgren said. "It doesn't figure," Giordino said. The Canadian military wouldn't try to instigate a conflict by masquerading as an American warship. What about these Athabasca escort ships? Pitt asked. By Canadian law, all commercial traffic through ice-clogged sections of the Northwest Passage requires an icebreaker escort, Stenzit said. A private firm, Athabasca Shipping, handles the escort duty. They operate a number of large icebreaker tugs, which are also used to haul their fleet of ocean-going barges. We saw one towing a string of enormous liquid natural gas barges passing through the Bering Strait a few weeks ago. Pitt's eyes lit up. He opened a briefcase and pulled out a photograph of a massive barge under construction in New Orleans. He handed the picture to Stenzith. "Any resemblance to this one?" Pitt asked. Stenzith looked at the photo and nodded. "Yes, it's positively the same type. You don't see barges of that size very often. What's the significance?" Pitt briefed the men on his hunt for the ruthenium, its trail to the Arctic, and Mitchell Goyette's possible involvement. He checked some additional papers that Yeager had provided, which confirmed that the Athabasca Shipping Company was owned by one of Goyette's holding companies. "If Goyette is shipping gas and oil from the Arctic, his environmental posturing is certainly fraudulent," Giordino noted. "A dock worker I met at a bar told me someone was shipping the Chinese massive quantities of oil sands, or bitumen, out of Kugluktuk," Dahlgren said. "He said they were bypassing the government's shutdown of refineries in Alberta due to greenhouse gas emissions." "A good bet it's on Goyette's barges," Pitt said. "Maybe it's even his oil sands." "It would seem that this Goyette might have a powerful incentive to obtain the ruthenium source," Stenzith said. "How do you propose beating him to it?" "By finding a 185-year-old ship," Pitt replied. He then shared Perlmutter's findings and the clues linking the mineral to Franklin's expedition ship, Erebus. "We know the ships were initially abandoned northwest of King William Island. The Inuit account places the Erebus farther south, so it is possible that a shifting ice sheet drove the ships in that direction before they sank." Stenzith excused himself to run to the bridge, while Dahlgren asked Pitt what he hoped to find. "Providing that the ice didn't completely crush the ships, there's a good chance the vessels are intact and in an excellent state of preservation due to the frigid water." Stenzith returned to the lounge with an armful of maps and photographs. He opened a nautical chart that showed the area around King William Island, then produced a high-altitude photo of the same region. "Satellite photo of Victoria Strait. We've got updates for the entire passage. Some areas north of here are still encased in sea ice, but the waters around King William have already broken up due to an early melt-off this year." He laid the photograph on the table for all to see. "The seas are essentially clear in the area where Franklin became icebound 165 years ago. A bit of drift ice still remains, but nothing that should impede a search effort." While Pitt nodded with satisfaction, Dahlgren was shaking his head. "Aren't we forgetting one mighty important tidbit?" he asked. "The Canadians have expelled us from their waters. The only reason we've been able to remain in Tuktoyaktuk so long is because we feigned problems with our rudder." "With your arrival, those problems have now been rectified," Stenzith said to Pitt with a wily smile. Pitt turned to Giordino. "Al, I believe you were tasked with proposing a strategy to address Jack's concern." "Well, as Jack can attest, we have taken the opportunity to befriend the small Canadian Coast Guard contingent stationed here in Tuk," Giordino said, using the locals' abbreviation for the town's Inuit name. "And while this has personally cost me a number of high bar tabs, in addition to a hangover or two for Jack, I believe I have made commendable progress." He opened one of the captain's charts that showed the western portion of the passage, then searched the coastline with his finger. "Cape Bathurst here is about 200 miles to the east of us. The Canadians have a radar station on the point, which they use to pick up all eastbound traffic through the passage. They can radio ahead to Kugluktuk, where a pair of vessels are stationed, or call back here to Tuk, where a small cutter is berthed. Fortunately for us, the Canadians have posted most of their intercept vessels on the other end of the passage, snaring the bulk of the traffic entering via Baffin Bay." Last time I checked, we didn't have stealth capabilities on our research ships, Pitt said. We don't necessarily need it, Giordino continued. As luck would have it, there's a Korean freighter here in port that struggled in with engine problems. The harbor master told me the repairs have been completed and that they'll be departing later today. The ship is only going so far as Kugluktuk with a load of oil drilling repair parts, so it'll be sailing without an icebreaker escort. You're suggesting that we shadow her? Pitt asked. Precisely. If we can hold tight to her port flank while we pass Bathurst, they might not pick us up. What about the Canadian picket vessels? Dahlgren asked. The Took cutter just came into port this morning, so she likely won't put to sea again right away, Giordino said. That leaves the two vessels in Kugluktuk. I'd bet one of them is probably hanging around the Polar Dawn, which was taken there. So that likely leaves just one vessel that we'd have to slide past. I'd say those are odds worth taking, Pitt stated. What about air surveillance? Can't we count on the Canadian Air Force to do an occasional flyby? Dahlgren asked. Stenzith pulled out another sheet from his pile. Mother Nature will lend us a hand there. The weather forecast for the next week is pretty dismal. If we set sail today, we'll probably accompany a slow-moving, low-pressure front that's forecast to roll through the archipelago. Stormy weather, Giordino said. We'll know why there's no plane up in the sky. Pitt looked around the table, eyeing the others with confidence. They were men of unquestioned loyalty that he could trust in difficult times. It's settled then, he said. We'll give the freighter a couple of hours' head start, then shove off ourselves. Make it look like we're headed back to Alaska. Once safely offshore, we'll circle back and catch the freighter well before Bathurst. Won't be a problem, Stenzith said. We've got at least 8 or 10 knots on her. One more thing, Pitt said. Until the politicians resolve the Polar Dawn situation, we are on our own. And there's a reasonable chance we could end up with the same fate. I want only a skeleton crew of volunteers aboard. Every scientist and non-essential crew member is to disembark here as quietly as possible. Do what you can to book them rooms and flights out of here. If anyone asks, tell them they are oil company employees who have been reassigned. It will be taken care of, Stenzith promised. Pitt set down his coffee and stared across the table with sudden unease. A painting hung on the opposite bulkhead, depicting a 19th-century sailing ship caught in a harrowing gale, its sails shredded and masts falling. A jagged cluster of rocks rose in its path, ready to bash the ship to bits. Stormy weather indeed, he thought.